Hey everybody, before we get started with today's episode of Morbidology, I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporter, Shannon Hegedus. I am eternally grateful for your support. You can support Morbidology on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. There's some cool extras up on there, like exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on Morbidology. The support on Patreon goes such a long way in helping this one-woman podcast continue to grow. Next up, a quick word from this week's sponsor, and then on with the show. Since you're listening to Morbidology, I don't doubt that you're a murder mystery fan. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing mobile puzzle game, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. Even better, this game is set in the 1920s and has a real glamorous aesthetic and a diverse cast of characters. Each scene in the game will take you through a murder mystery, but along the way, you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets. What I really love about this game is that it's super therapeutic and even relaxing, but at the same time, it truly tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I especially like to play this game late at night before I go to bed. So go ahead and download June's Journey for free at the Apple App Store or Google Play, or click the link in my show notes. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. It was shortly after midnight in St. Petersburg, Florida, on the 8th of January 2015, when a police officer was heading home down I-275 after finishing his shift. Moments later, a PT Cruiser sped past him at around 100 miles per hour. The officer tried to keep up with the car to pull it over. When they reached the Dick Meisner Bridge on the approach to the Skyway, the car pulled over and the officer pulled up behind him. Nobody could have ever predicted what happened next. The man got out of the car and started heading towards the officer, who pulled out his weapon and ordered him to stop. The man didn't stop and mumbled something under his breath that the officer could not translate. The man opened the back door of his car and grabbed a little girl from the back seat, lifted her from the car while holding her face to his chest. The man rushed to the side of the bridge and threw the child into Tampa Bay. Before the officer even had a chance to react, the man jumped back in his car and sped off.
When I saw him discard Phoebe over the side of the bridge, my immediate concern was, please let me see her in the water so we can help her.
The officer ran to the bridge to look down into the dark waters to see if he could see the little girl. He immediately called emergency services while he climbed on a ladder to get into the water to try and rescue the little girl, calling out at her to let him know that she was okay. There was nothing but silence and the rushing waters. A search team rushed to the scene and an all-out search effort was launched. The extensive search was assisted by the Coast Guard and the Eckerd College Search and Rescue Team. Sadly, it was already too late. The little girl's body was discovered around an hour and 40 minutes after she was thrown from the bridge. She was floating face up around a half mile from the bridge. She was wearing a neon Granimals t-shirt, shorts, and a gold cross around her neck. Rescue teams desperately attempted to revive the little girl, but at 2:44 a.m., she was pronounced dead at hospital. After throwing the little girl into the water, the man drove south on Manatee County. An all-points bulletin had been sent out, and around 5 minutes later, police caught up with him but did not initially turn their lights on. The man initially stopped, turned his blinkers on, to which the police responded by putting their lights on. The man then did a U-turn, driving up the interstate the wrong way, where he almost hit a police officer near the University Parkway exit. Officers had to use traffic spikes to stop the man's vehicle. When they approached his car, he refused to get out and refused to speak to them. The officers were forced to break the car window to drag the man out and arrest him. Following his arrest, he was taken into custody and brought back to St. Petersburg for questioning. The little girl was subsequently identified as 5-year-old Phoebe Johnchuk, and the man who threw her into the cold water was identified as her father, John Nicholas Johnchuk. John was charged with first-degree murder and booked into the Pinellas County Jail. Speaking with an officer, John referred to his arrest as a conspiracy and stated, "My name is God, and you shall address me as such. I command you take me to the city of Babylon now." During his arraignment, John asked for divine intervention. Chief Anthony Holloway of the St. Petersburg Police Department said that in his 29 years of employment with the force, he couldn't comprehend what was going through John's mind. Speaking with the media, he said, "He may have some mental issues, but he didn't even really want to talk. We're still searching the car, so I don't think there's any drugs involved." Police additionally announced that they were unsure if Phoebe was alive when she was thrown into the water. An autopsy would be performed to determine a cause of death. According to the officer who had witnessed the tragedy, he believed that he heard Phoebe scream as she was thrown over the bridge. Outside of the police station, Officer Yolanda Fernandez said, "It's unfathomable. I mean, an officer sees all kinds of things, but it's still very difficult to see something like this unfold before your very eyes. What could make someone throw someone over a railing, let alone your own child?" Following John's arrest, details of past charges came to the surface. On the 23rd of May, John was arrested on battery and domestic violence charges after attacking Michelle Kerr. Then on the 25th of May, 2013, he was charged once again with battery. And once again, his victim was Michelle Kerr. Michelle was Phoebe's mother. On the 25th of October, 2013, John had been charged with forging Michelle's checks, but she signed a waiver not to prosecute. On the 5th of November, 2013, John was charged with battery after attacking his mother, Michelle Johnchuk, during the course of an argument. On the 24th of April, 2014, John was charged with battery after he and a male acquaintance got into a physical altercation. However, they both refused to press charges. Just the day after John's arrest, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office said that they had two closed child protection cases forwarded to the Department of Children and Families on the Johnchuk family, and one that was still open. They said that the cases involved John and Michelle, and around a month beforehand, John had requested a restraining order against Michelle, but the request had been denied. John and Michelle had been together for around 6 tumultuous years. They had met in 2008 through a mutual friend. When they first met, Michelle knew John as a gay man, and he quickly became what she described as her gay best friend. Not too long after they met, however, John informed her that he also liked women, and soon enough, they became a couple. Around a year later, Phoebe was born. Phoebe had long curly hair and an enchanting smile. She loved princesses, colouring in and everything girly and pretty. She especially loved drawing. She would draw cats, tracings of her own hands, and declarations of love, which she gifted to those she cared for. She always wrote her K's and J's backwards, and almost always in the colours pink and purple. While some kids can be fussy eaters, Phoebe ate every single thing placed down in front of her. According to her family, she was wild about fruit and would eat 2 cans of peaches in one sitting. Her favourite TV show was Disney Channel's Doc McStuffins, and she dreamed of becoming a doctor or a dancer when she grew up. She loved hide and seek and was said to be laughably bad at it, often hiding in the same spot over and over again. Phoebe had been a student at Cleveland Elementary School, and Susan Brill, the principal, described Phoebe as a vibrant kindergarten student who had a massive smile on her face each morning when she arrived for class. In school, she loved music and dance and was always the first to make up a game in the playground. She was known to be friendly to every single person she met, and there wasn't a single person she didn't speak to in the morning when she came in. The one thing that Phoebe did not like was baths and water, and this made her death all the more tragic. At the time of Phoebe's murder, John had custody of her, and just the day before her murder, an attorney who had represented John in the past had reported him to police and child welfare. Genevieve Torres confirmed to the media that she had reported John, and police confirmed that they received the report. However, neither confirmed what the report was about. Michelle, of course, was distraught over what had transpired. Speaking with the Associated Press, following John's arrest, she said, "I always saw him as a good dad. She would always say, 'I love you, Daddy.' She loved her dad. She was my little angel baby. She always was. Now she really is."
She was my angel. I always called her my angel baby. She loved to learn new things. She loved to make you smile. She loved to love. I would say to him, "For Phoebe." And it's always, always been for Phoebe. "I don't hate you. Okay?" She wouldn't want me to. You were her dad.
Linda Mados, the owner of a daycare that looked after Phoebe, said that in 2013, John and Phoebe had been homeless. Due to a back injury, John had been unable to work, and Linda allowed them to stay in her house for a period, but when John started to pick fights with her, she had to ask them to leave. However, after John left Linda's house, he was seemingly furious with the fact that she had kicked him out. She said that he attempted to get revenge on her by reporting her to CPS. In fact, it would be discovered that John had also called CPS on Michelle in the past as well. The last time that Michelle had seen John and Phoebe was at Christmas Eve. She said that they had a nice evening together and there were no arguments and no disagreements. However, for reasons unknown to Michelle, after she left that night, John called CPS and made false allegations against Michelle. She described John as Jekyll and Hyde and said that something in his head was not wired right. Despite this, however, she said that she never believed in a million years that John would ever hurt Phoebe. According to Melody Dishman, a childhood friend of John who had let John and Phoebe live with her for several months while they were homeless, she saw a different side to John. She said that while John never hit Phoebe or was never physical with Phoebe, she did hear him yelling at her quite often and locking her in her bedroom. She said, "She didn't want to be around John. I could see it in her eyes. She had the most beautiful smile. She was so funny. She had the cutest laugh." After living with Linda and Melody, John had moved in with his father, John Chuck Sr. John Sr. told police that he had seen John and Phoebe in the house on Wednesday night, but said that after he went to bed for the night, they must have left the house. Shortly thereafter, it would be revealed that John's attorney, Genevieve, had reported him to police and DCF because she feared that he may have been planning to harm his daughter. According to Genevieve, John had been in her office at the Family First Law Group in Lutz with Phoebe to go over legal paperwork regarding custody. John had filed for full legal custody of Phoebe. Phoebe had been drawing pictures while John was acting extremely bizarre. He kept calling Genevieve God and asked her to translate the Bible into Swedish. He additionally told her not to bother filing anything in the custody case because it wouldn't matter anymore. As soon as they left her office, Genevieve had called police.
Hi.
911, what's your emergency?
Yes, okay. I have a client that came in. It's a client of mine. He hired me yesterday. I'm a family attorney. He just came in, and then right now he's going to, he has a child with him, his daughter. He left my office. He came out there with a Bible and started talking to me and saying that I was the creator, I was God, and then he wanted me to read the Bible to him. I said, I can't. It's in Swedish. And he started being really, I mean, he thought he's nuts.
What? Okay.
And he's going out with a child.
Huh? Did you say he assaulted you?
No, he didn't. But what I'm saying is he's out of his mind, and he has a minor child with him driving to a church now, and I should have kept the child. And he was saying things like, I was supposed to file his paperwork today for a case. He's like, well, don't file the paperwork. It's not going to matter anymore. And then he wanted me to take him to the church, and then he wanted to leave the child here, and I should have kept the child, but now he's left with the child.
Okay, did he make statements like he wanted to harm himself?
No, but he keeps saying things like that he said that he keeps saying that I was the, he keeps saying that I was God, and I keep saying I wasn't. And he said that he needs to go to the church to get baptized now, and that he not to file anything because things are not going to matter anymore. And he wanted to leave the child here, and then he didn't want to drive, and then he wanted to drive. So I don't know if he's on drugs.
How long ago did he leave?
He just 5 minutes ago. He's on his way to, huh?
What is he driving?
Oh, Kirsten, did you see his car? He's driving a white, tiny car that kind of looks like a thing.
Like a two-door car?
Is it a two-door or four-door? I know he's on his way. I'm close by the church. He's on his way.
All right, stay on the phone with me.
I should have given the child.
During the phone call, Genevieve becomes overcome with emotion and broke down in tears. She expressed great regret that she did not try to keep Phoebe in her office and try to prevent John from taking her with him. Before she hung up, Genevieve asked if her report could be kept anonymous because she was worried that it would anger John. After hanging up, John called Genevieve repeatedly that afternoon, which was when she called the DCF Child Abuse Hotline. After the first phone call, police had been able to track down John and Phoebe at St. Paul's Church on Dale Mabry Highway in Tampa. When they arrived, John was speaking with a priest who he had asked to perform an exorcism on him because he was possessed and asked him to be baptized.
So my experience with John, John's not a parishioner here.
Right.
I'm not sure how he found our parish, was looking for spiritual advice. So he had an appointment with me, came in with his daughter. I was impressed with her. She's a very bright and very beautiful little girl, very, very beautiful. What impressed me about her is that usually when I see parents, I'll have the kids sit in the next room over in color, whatever. In this case, she went with the secretary and went to our religious ed offices with those ladies and did coloring and everything else, but she was on the other side of the building. I was impressed with her sense of self, that she had the confidence to do that, because I think a lot of kids would have been sort of intimidated being in a strange building and being with strange people. My interview with John went well. I mean, he's a 25-year-old, was confused, had a spiritual experience, wanted to grow in the Lord. He had told me that he had a history of and diagnosed with psychological problems. But aside from the fact that I could tell that he was struggling, there wasn't anything that came out that was sort of hinted of any sort of danger to him or to his family or anyone else. Halfway through the interview, I received a phone call that the sheriff's office was here, and they had received a complaint or a concern from someone that he might hurt himself. So after I was finished, I talked with him about that and sort of bridged the gap so that he would be able to go to the police officers and that there wouldn't be any sort of trauma or drama, for that matter. And they had their interview with him, and afterwards he left. I gave him a Bible, and he was supposed to be here tonight, actually, for some classes.
Later on in the day, he was trying to join.
Yeah, he wanted to be baptized. He had a spiritual experience and wanted to be baptized. I think that earlier we had he called and said that he, you know, felt tormented, you know. So I think that he was looking for spiritual relief, thinking that his mental problems might have had a spiritual cause, if you will. So he came back about an hour, 2 hours later. And at this point, he was more agitated and really sort of insisting that he be baptized on the spot, which we don't do. There's a period of preparation that's required.
The two officers interviewed John for around 20 minutes. He had been able to answer their questions without confusion or hesitation, and John informed the officers that he did not want to harm himself or his daughter. Police said that they appeared to be in good health and simply left the issue at that, despite what Genevieve had said to them and despite the fact that John was wearing his pajamas. Following the interview, John and Phoebe left the church together. As Phoebe walked away, she turned back and waved to the officers. Several hours later, Phoebe would be dead. This wasn't the only report to police regarding John's behaviour in the run-up to Phoebe's murder. John's childhood friend, Melody, had called police 2 days before the murder. She said that she had received what she described as scary text messages from John, wherein he called her names and claimed to have found Jesus. Police simply told Melody to apply for a restraining order. When news of Phoebe's tragic murder made its way to Cleveland Elementary School, officials brought in crisis counselors to help students to try to process the tragedy.
Well, the crisis team was notified first thing this morning. Mrs. Brill, the principal, alerted our supervisors, and we came out and we met with the staff here, with Ms. Brill and some of the other team members, and just pretty much brainstormed how we want to support this school family. And so the crisis team initiated conversation with the first kindergarten classroom, and we talked with the students. We let them know that they had lost a member of their classmates, and the students are very resilient. The faculty and staff has been very nurturing and supportive of our efforts. And we've had a wonderful outcome. And the students have expressed, you know, their fondness of this little girl, and they've drawn pictures and just had an opportunity to really just share some wonderful memories.
Meanwhile, Phoebe's classmates all shared their fond memories of Phoebe and drew pictures to remember her by. A number of the drawings were vibrant and colourful, and as Dr. Evelyn Hernandez said, they reflected the children's feelings about Phoebe. Following Phoebe's death, Florida's Department of Children and Families announced that they would be immediately changing their abuse hotline criteria. They confirmed that at 2:45 p.m. on the day of the murder, they had received a phone call to their abuse hotline from Genevieve, who had reported that John was depressed and delusional. While police had responded to Genevieve's concerns, DCF had not. According to Genevieve, as far as Child Protective Services, they didn't accept my report. They said that it didn't meet the criteria that they were going under as far as when they should go out to check on a child. Under the new DCF protocol, if a caretaker of a child is believed to be experiencing a psychotic episode, a child protective investigator must go and visit the child within 4 hours of the call. DCF additionally announced that they would be investigating their own actions. Meanwhile, a judge denied bond for John. During the court appearance, John appeared to be dazed and confused and acted defiantly towards the judge and asked to leave his faith in the hands of God.
Can you hear me, sir?
Yes.
You are John Janchuk?
That's the name that I was given.
Okay, thank you. You're here on a charge of aggravated assault on a law enforcement officer, and your bond is currently set at $10,000. You're here on a charge of aggravated fleeing or eluding and eluding a police officer. Your bond is set at $10,000. You're also here on a charge of murder in the first degree, and you have no bond. Can you hire your own lawyer? Do you have the wherewithal to hire an attorney, sir?
No.
Judge, I'm sorry to interrupt. Has he been sworn?
He has not been sworn. Would you like me to appoint an attorney to represent you?
No.
Are you sure?
I want to leave it in the hands of God.
Okay. So you want to represent yourself?
I want to leave it in the hands of God.
Pretty sure God's not going to be representing you in this case. And you're going to be standing trial. Would you like someone standing next to you as you're standing trial?
Yes.
An attorney.
That is pure and good, not evil.
I'm going to do the best I can to give you a pure and good lawyer. If you'll raise your right hand.
He's handcuffed, Your Honor.
Can he raise his right hand?
I don't want a court-appointed lawyer. I want to leave it in the hands of God.
Point Dr. Poorman. Bring him back on Monday to see if he wants an attorney. Bonds remain. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Afterwards, Michelle sat down with the Tampa Bay Times to talk about John and Phoebe and revealed the extent of their turbulent relationship. She said that John quite often hit her when they were together and he had stopped her from seeing her daughter. On occasions, John punched Michelle, pushed her to the ground, and dragged her around by the hair. She said that he quite often seemed unstable, but said she had always trusted him around Phoebe. She additionally repeatedly said she wished she could have taken Phoebe's place. Before the murder, John had been hospitalized under the Baker Act and had been prescribed medication to treat bipolar disorder. Michelle said that he often said things that made no sense, and at times, he was on Seroquel, Zoloft, and other medications. However, abuse allegations had come from both sides, and in May of 2013, after John was arrested, after being accused of grabbing Michelle and throwing her to the ground, after uncovering messages from another man, John said, "Michelle Kerr violently attacked me with a box cutter after being confronted about a secret Facebook in which she had been having an affair. That evening, she brutally kept striking me in the face." In court papers, John had accused Michelle of being unable to care for Phoebe. He accused her of having mental health issues and being a drug and alcohol abuser. As it turned out, Florida Department of Children and Family investigators had agreed with John and forbid Michelle from having direct contact with Phoebe. This, of course, was crushing to Michelle. A couple of weeks after the injunction, she emailed John and asked if she could come and visit Phoebe. When he ignored her, she showed up at Phoebe's daycare and asked if she could see Phoebe. John subsequently accused Michelle of violating the injunction, and that resulted in amended injunctions, which prolonged the time Michelle was forbidden from seeing her daughter. According to Michelle, she very rarely knew where John and Phoebe were staying because they moved around so much. However, she knew that John was taking Phoebe to school and taking her to doctor appointments, so didn't ever fear that she was in danger. She believed that John had been taking care of Phoebe. While Michelle hadn't been able to see Phoebe, she said that she had spoken to her on several occasions. She thought back to one somber phone call wherein Phoebe asked her mother if she still loved her. St. Petersburg police soon enough released a statement which said that they had preliminary evidence which indicated that Phoebe was alive when she was thrown into the water. In the wake of Phoebe's death, many began questioning where the mental health system had gone so wrong or why John's issues hadn't been properly addressed. According to State Representative Kathleen Peters, there were so many gaps in Florida's approach to mental health care. Florida is 49th in the nation when it comes to per capita mental health care spending, and as Karen Koch, Vice President of the Florida Council of Community Mental Health, the barrier for accessing mental health care was statewide. State Representative Kathleen Peters had spent a long time gathering information on Florida's mental health care system and found that one of the major issues in the state was workforce shortage. A lot of public programs and nonprofits were unable to pay social workers what other companies could be paying them, so vacancies were difficult to fill. In fact, DCF Secretary Mike Carroll said that less than 90% of vacancies were being filled. He subsequently announced that he would be deploying the Critical Incident Rapid Response Team to assess the investigation and interventions with Phoebe's family prior to her murder, and said that the investigation would likely take around a month. He described Phoebe's murder as horrifying and said he couldn't even begin to imagine the terror that Phoebe felt during her last moments on Earth. According to DCF records, the first contact they had with Phoebe's family was in April of 2012, when they had been informed that John was a crystal meth user who had choked Michelle and locked Phoebe in a bedroom where powerful medication was located. At the time this report was placed, unspecified extended family members had already been the subject of 7 earlier reports to DCF, spanning back to 1997. A former landlord had also reported John and Michelle to DCF after he discovered drug paraphernalia inside the family's home, as well as several doors that had been kicked in. Furthermore, the landlord had to replace windows that had been smashed by the couple, and he had worried for Phoebe's safety. When reporting the couple, he described them both as very erratic. When the case was closed by DCF, they had concluded that Phoebe wasn't at risk because John and Michelle had moved to a new home, and the new home was observed by DCF and found to be free of any environmental hazards. According to the notation on the files, there were no concerns for the family. However, just days before this notation, another notation had read that John's psychiatrist had told them that John had not shown up for his domestic violence counselling appointment and had failed to reschedule. In 2013, DCF had been contacted once again with allegations that Michelle had been abusing methamphetamine, cocaine, and alcohol, and had then been hostile. According to the report, Michelle had attacked John with a box cutter. The report read in part, "There is a problem with Phoebe not being bathed. There are some concerns regarding the mother having adequate food in the home." DCF investigators found that Phoebe was at some risk because of the ongoing violence between her parents, but despite this, no action was taken. Then the month before Phoebe's murder, DCF had received another report alleging that John did not have a stable home and was moving from place to place with Phoebe in tow. The caller said that they had been living with family members, but other family members had accused those family members of being alcoholics and therefore not a stable place for a child to be living. The caller also reported that Michelle continued with drug and mental health problems and was living with a man who was violent towards her. Including the DCF call from John's attorney, that made at least 4 reports to DCF and at least 6 domestic violence reports to police. A memorial was held for Phoebe on the 11th of January at her grandfather's home, where Phoebe had been living at the time of her murder. Her grandmother, Michelle, said that she couldn't comprehend what her son had done and why. She said, "Right now, I have no intention of talking to him because nothing could give me an answer to what he's done." She said that even if she did speak to John, she didn't think he would explain his actions. A number of Phoebe's toys and books were displayed in the home as the somber event took place. Michelle stated, "My whole family loved her so much, and they did everything in the world for her." The following day, John appeared in court where he refused to answer any questions. The judge ordered that a public defender be appointed to represent him. Now, the family had the daunting task of preparing for Phoebe's funeral. In a kind gesture, Blount & Curry Funeral Home in Carrollwood announced that they would be paying for Phoebe's funeral. Her uncle, Brian Morris, and other members of the family had gone to make arrangements, and when Brian handed over his credit card to pay, they were told, "This is on us." The kind gesture brought the family to tears, and Brian stated, "There are a lot of good people left in the world." Peter O'Connor, the market director for the funeral home, said that they had children themselves and just wanted to do something to help the family out. The funeral home's caterers and florists also donated their services. The funeral was held at Lake Magdalene Methodist Church in Tampa, which held 800 people. Mourners were asked to dress in Phoebe's memory. Phoebe loved bright colours, and her family asked everybody to dress brightly. On the morning of the funeral, Phoebe's mother, Michelle, exchanged hugs and ushered mourners into the church. At the front of the church sat Phoebe's small, open casket, surrounded in flowers. Inside the dainty casket, Phoebe was wearing a rainbow striped t-shirt. She was enshrined with all of the things that she loved the most. Her art projects, her school books, and her teddy bears. The funeral was led by Pastor Brent Byerman, who said, "When we try to wrestle with the whys, we say things like, maybe it was God's will. At this time, I can't quite believe that. Many things happened to this girl that were not the will of God." The mourners bowed their heads in prayer and sang a number of hymns. A slideshow depicting Phoebe's short life was projected onto two overhead screens. The photograph showed Phoebe with a group of classmates sitting beside Santa Claus, Phoebe lying beside a dog and giving the peace sign, and Phoebe with her arms open, waiting for a hug from a relative, among others. Phoebe's grandmother, Michelle, read out a letter she had penned to her granddaughter, which read in part, "I love you. You are so sweet. You made Mama's life complete." She clutched on to Phoebe's doll, Lucy, and said that Phoebe was her whole world. Her teacher, Mika Oliver, told the crowd that Phoebe absolutely loved school and said that she was still very much part of the class, and her classmates imagine her with fluffy purple wings and a golden halo in heaven. Following the service, Phoebe was buried in Lake Carroll Cemetery. A news conference was held outside the church following the burial, wherein Phoebe's family said that they wanted the world to know that despite the issues with Phoebe's parents, she was very much loved. Her uncle, Brian, said,
"There's been so much about Phoebe's life, and so much of it to this point hasn't necessarily been 100% true. She truly was loved. You saw the smile on her face, and she had a smile that would light up a room."
Her grandmother, Michelle, said,
"Phoebe was an angel here, and she's an angel up there now. And I, as her mama, loved her more than anything in the entire world. I gave her everything I could and all the love that I could ever give."
They said that donations in Phoebe's memory could be made to a fund that had been set up to benefit her school, Cleveland Elementary. Phoebe had loved school, so it was a fitting tribute. The following month, DCF admitted that their abuse hotline had screened out not one, but two calls about potential danger to Phoebe in the week preceding her death. Secretary Carroll admitted, "In hindsight, looking at those calls, we probably should have accepted them both, and we should have initiated an investigation on John Johnchuk." The report was released and cited numerous errors that led to Phoebe's death. In particular, the two final calls that came on the 29th of December and the 7th of January. The call on the 29th alleged past harm to Phoebe and current concerns regarding her living arrangements. The hotline counselor who took the phone call informed the caller that the report was being investigated, but terminated the call before the caller had even given the chance to confirm John's address. The hotline counselor had also failed to call back, as DCF protocol requires, to say that it hadn't been accepted at all. Furthermore, they found that the family had not been referred for intervention services in 2013 when they accepted a call about an earlier threat to Phoebe. Just the day after the report was released, two doctors told Judge Christine Hellinger that they found John to be mentally incompetent. The judge ordered a hearing for the 27th of February to determine whether John had the mental capability to understand the case filed against him. Shortly before the hearing, it was announced that an employee with DCF had been suspended for failing to act on a call they had received from Genevieve. Janae Washington said that she did not pass the call on to investigators because she couldn't verify John's address. She was suspended for 3 days and was cited by a state DCF official for mishandling the call in a disciplinary letter. During the competency hearing, the judge ruled that John was incompetent to stand trial. That meant that he would be sent to a state psychiatric hospital in a bid to restore his mental condition so that he could face trial. Shortly thereafter, court records were released, which revealed further insight into John's mindset at the time of the murder. According to John's stepmother, John had been saying that he wanted to get baptized and had become obsessed with people jumping off Sunshine Skyway. Inside his home, police had discovered three lines of sea salt, which John believed would keep demons from entering the home. Furthermore, he had been sleeping with a Bible. According to John's mother, he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but had not been taking his medication. According to a friend, John had told her that if he ever did anything to get into big trouble, he would claim insanity. He also said that he was God and wanted to kill her because he was a demon now. On the 5th of January, he had emailed a friend about making amends and had said that he wanted forgiveness for acting bad. He wrote, "It's amazing what life brings you when you give up your addictions and what it's like to be normal." The same day, he texted another friend saying, "I found the key to unlock my gift. I forgive you all." While another message read, "Every day I am one step closer and I feel like a million bucks. Thank you for everything." It would be revealed that there were warning signs that John was unpredictable and violent. He himself had grown up in a tumultuous family marred by domestic violence. When John was 17 years old, he moved out of home. He started to smoke spice before moving on to crystal meth. He developed an addiction that followed him into adulthood. While he was arrested for drug offences, according to his childhood friend, Amanda Serrano, he got high every few hours. His fingertips had been charred from holding the glass pipe so frequently. When Phoebe was born, however, things seemingly changed for a while. Michelle was working while John stayed at home. However, when Michelle was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, she left work and went on to disability. John sponged off Michelle, forged checks, and scammed people. Soon enough, domestic violence became common in the household. In February of 2016, John was once again ruled incompetent to stand trial. He remained in a state psychiatric hospital, and then in March of 2017, he was determined to be competent. It was additionally announced that the state would be seeking the death penalty against John. Judge Chris Hellinger scheduled the trial to begin in February of 2018. However, shortly thereafter, it was pushed back until September. Shortly after that, the state attorney's office announced that they had taken the death penalty off the table. They did not elaborate as to why, but many speculated that it was related to John's mental health issues. The trial was once again pushed back until spring of 2019. As the case was making its way through the justice system, court files were released which revealed that John had told a doctor in hospital that voices had urged him to kill Phoebe. He had said, "I was hearing voices saying that if me and Phoebe didn't die, everybody was going to hell." He had said these words to psychiatrist Emily Lazarou during an evaluation. Emily had asked who was going to die, and John replied, "Everybody in the world." He additionally told her that he had nightmares about his daughter, wherein she was lying there and he can't wake her up. He said, "I think about her every night, in the mornings when I wake up, because I was a really good father and she loved me so much, and I always promised her that I'm not going to let anything happen, and I did." The trial began on the 25th of March, 2019. When John walked into the courtroom, his physical appearance was shocking. He had been transformed by serious weight loss and looked extremely frail. He rocked back and forth in his chair and appeared to bounce up and down in his chair. During opening statements, prosecutor Paul Bolin walked the jury through the last moments of Phoebe's life.
The white PT Cruiser is being driven by this defendant, John Johnchuck Jr. Now, Officer Vickers gets to the top of the bridge and he sees that the vehicle has stopped, and so he immediately pulls alongside it. If you're going south in the Dick Meisner Bridge, they're on the right side of the bridge. There's a short wall and then there's the water below. So Officer Vickers pulls in about 15 feet behind the white PT Cruiser. He doesn't know what to expect at this point. The vehicle stopped on its own. A few moments later, Officer Vickers sees the defendant, John Johnchuck Jr., the man sitting right behind me, emerge from the driver's side of the vehicle. Officer Vickers at this point is expecting a confrontation because you'll remember he thought this was maybe a stolen vehicle. never imagined what he was about to witness. The defendant exits his vehicle from the driver's side and walks toward Officer Vickers. At this point, Officer Vickers has his firearm drawn, ready for that confrontation. The defendant makes a statement. He says, "You," referring to Officer Vickers, "you have no free will." And then the defendant walks between the two vehicles and then around in front of Officer Vickers to the passenger side of his white PT Cruiser. He opens the door, and at this point, Officer Vickers believes the defendant is about to retrieve a weapon, a firearm. His gun is at the ready. He's been trained for this moment. The defendant goes inside of the vehicle, and instead of retrieving a firearm or a weapon, retrieves a child. A 5-year-old, blonde-haired little girl named Phoebe. Takes the child out of the vehicle. The officer can see she had just been awakened. She's clearly alive, a real child. The defendant takes her from the vehicle, turns, and then lets go. He drops her from a height of about 70 feet into the dark water of Tampa Bay. The officer heard her scream on the way down.
He painted the outline of a premeditated killing and described the moment that Phoebe was pulled out of the dark waters. Her body was cold to the touch, and there was frothy liquid in her lungs and bruises on her back. He reminded the jury that it would be the defense's burden to prove insanity, but said that it would be easy to say that John was insane. He urged them to look beyond the superficial and said that he would be able to prove that John knew exactly what he was doing when he tossed his daughter off the bridge and knew that it was wrong.
Members of the jury, the defendant was sane when he committed this murder. He's presumed sane today, unless shown to you by clear and convincing evidence otherwise. He was sane when he committed that murder. He is the one who did it, and we are asking that you hold him responsible for it. There's only one verdict that speaks the truth in this case, and we believe that if you follow the evidence, if you apply the law and you apply your own common sense, you will return the only verdict supported by all three: the evidence, the law, and your common sense. And that is a verdict of guilty. Guilty of first-degree murder for the death of Phoebe Johnchuck.
He went on to urge the jury to take into consideration John's custody battle and familial friction. He said that Michelle was dating a new man and John feared losing custody of Phoebe. He said that John felt enraged that his own mother was taking better care of Phoebe than she ever took of him. He put forward the theory that John was looking to lash out at something and somebody, and that the murder was not the result of a psychotic break. Turning to the jury, he said, "You will see that John Johnchuck committed this murder to punish his own mother and the mother of Phoebe. He told his mother before the murder that he would fuck up the rest of her life, and he made good on that promise." Defense attorney Jessica Manuel started her opening statements by asking the jury not to try and make sense of what happened.
It didn't make sense at the time. It doesn't make sense today. It will never make sense, because it is insanity.
She stated that the defense were not trying to argue that John did not kill his daughter, but instead they would be arguing that John was legally insane the moment that he let go of Phoebe, sending her plunging into the dark waters below. She described his youth and stated that he was passed around like a hot potato, from mother to father to uncles and then to his father again. She said that John had sought mental health treatment while a young adult and said that he struggled holding on to a job and struggled to control his emotions. He had been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and bipolar disorder. Attorney Manuel divulged that John had been prescribed a plethora of medications over the years and had experimented with a number of different combinations in a bid to find one that worked. Then in 2013, he stopped seeing his doctor and started to ration his medication to to try and get them to last longer. She told the jury about a 2014 Thanksgiving meal wherein John dined across from Michelle and her new boyfriend. Attorney Manuel said that this was the breaking point for John, which sparked extreme jealousy and rage. The first person to be called to testify was Officer William Vickers, the police officer who had witnessed John throwing Phoebe off the bridge. Officer Vickers had been raised Baptist, and before the trial, he had said that God would only give people what they could handle, and said that he had a duty to be Phoebe's voice at trial.
It was initially very difficult to talk about it, because it made me so angry, it brought me to tears. I can't think of a victim other than a child. Who needs that voice as much?
When he took to the witness stand, he first of all took the jury through the night in question. He said that his shift had ended for the night and he was heading home when John sped up and passed him.
As it passed me, it whipped between myself and another vehicle that was also southbound, causing us to both take evasive action, and the speed with which it passed me moved my vehicle on the roadway.
He said that he pulled up behind John when he stopped on the bridge. He described how the highway lights were dim and that there was a gusty wind.
The driver was already out of the vehicle and began approaching me with something large in his hand. Based on training that I've seen at that point, I was fearful for a violent encounter. I drew my firearm and maintained it in a low ready with the anticipation of a firefight. The driver continued to approach me. I ordered them back into the car. They did not respond. As they continued to approach, the driver yelled, "You have no free will," and crossed in between the two cars. At that point, the driver walked around to the passenger side and reached in. I ordered the driver to show me their hands. They still did not comply. At that point, I was still anticipating a violent encounter, possibly firearm related. The driver emerged from the vehicle holding a small child who appeared to be asleep at the time, turned and let the child go over the side of the bridge.
He described how he remembered seeing Phoebe's long hair disappear over the bridge and told the jury,
"I did. I heard a faint scream and a splash."
His testimony was brief because there was going to be no debate as to whether John had actually murdered Phoebe. Following his testimony, John's mother, Michelle, testified. She was wearing bright pink in memory of her granddaughter, as well as a yellow butterfly necklace. Phoebe loved butterflies. The necklace had a pendant with part of Phoebe's handprint etched onto the metal. Michelle said that she believed that Phoebe was her chance at a course correction. Phoebe had given Michelle a purpose to do good and make amends after a criminal past marred by drug abuse. She admitted that John didn't have a good upbringing and admitted that both she and John's father had abandoned him. She told the jury that in the last months of Phoebe's life, she had been living with her and she was essentially her primary caregiver. Dr. Christopher Wilson, the pathologist who conducted Phoebe's autopsy, also testified during trial. He showed photographs of Phoebe's back and legs, which showed deep purple and red bruises. He told the jury that Phoebe had hit something during her long fall, which had caused the extensive bruising. The jury were next shown a video of John that was taken after his arrest.
I went looking for answers. I've always had problems growing up, like wondering who I was and how and what my purpose was. And ever since yesterday, and a couple days before,
like what? Problems? How do you think you're different?
Well, it's like, I don't know. Like when I went to the church
What church?
St. Paul's Catholic Church, and I spoke to Father Bill. Mm-hmm. He told me that I wasn't going to be ready this Easter, but next Easter, and that I was the Pope. Francis or whatever is not like...
He's not the real Pope?
Yes. And my grandma's name, and I do have Greek heritage, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. My grandma's maiden name is Vladimir. And it's always been weird, and I've had people coming up to me recently and asking me what my name is, and I've only been able to say John. Prior to this, weeks prior to this, like, and they would ask me what my last name is, and I would just say John.
Like, you just physically couldn't say your last name, or
it just
John Chuck, or he's just John.
It was just John for some reason, and it's like I really had to kind of think about it for a minute.
Then that's just been going on this past week.
Yeah.
At times in the video, John seemed composed and even articulate. But then at other times, he spoke about becoming the Pope and made vague allusions to conspiracies, as well as his belief that he was being manipulated by something. After being questioned for around an hour, John said,
Phoebe was my daughter. Mm-hmm. Phoebe J. John Chuck. Is she okay?
The prosecution's case against John only took 2 days to present. Next, it was up to the defense to try and present an argument as to why John had done what he had done. They first of all called attorney Genevieve Torres as their first witness. She told the jury that John first went to her office on the 6th of January 2015 to discuss custody. She said that he appeared normal and she saw no red flags or any reason to worry for his well-being or Phoebe's well-being. In fact, she said that she was impressed with how much information he gave her. However, when he returned the following day, his behaviour was the polar opposite. She said he showed up in his pyjamas and had a Swedish Bible, which he asked her to read to him. She told the jury that John said, "You're the creator, you speak all languages, you know how to speak Swedish." The defence also called Officer Troy Harp to the stand, who spoke about bizarre text messages that John had sent to his uncle in the days leading up to Phoebe's murder, as well as Sergeant Teresa Hubble, who had said that John kept referring to himself as the fallen angel Michael. John's father, John Johnchuck Sr., was also called as a defense witness. He told the jury that he believed that when Michelle was pregnant with John, she had abused drugs. He also said that on 3 different occasions, John had been placed into involuntary custody under the Baker Act when he was deemed a threat to himself or to others. There was also testimony from a woman named Tara Vallis. On the 7th of January, she had seen John outside of her apartment with Phoebe. She said that he was holding Phoebe's hand and pacing back and forward aimlessly. She also said that it was cold, but Phoebe was wearing shorts and no shoes. She said, "Something wasn't right. He looked like somebody who had 1,000 thoughts running through their head." John's mother, Michelle, was also called back to the stand to testify. She told the jury that in the days leading up to Phoebe's murder, John had been acting extremely bizarre. She said that he kept calling her a fallen angel and was worried that Phoebe was possessed and claimed that drywall had been making her sick. She said that John was also worried about losing custody of Phoebe.
He said her eyes looked possessed.
Did her eyes look any different?
No. He pulled out a Bible from underneath the pillow.
Was he just waking up when you walked in?
Yes.
So he had been sleeping with the Bible under his pillow?
Yes. I never really thought that he would ever do anything to hurt his daughter because he loved his daughter.
But he didn't want Michelle to get her, did he?
No.
Didn't want Guy Kisser to get her, did he?
No.
And told you he was going to f*** up your life, didn't he?
Yes.
And a few days later he murders her, right?
Yes.
Nothing else, Judge.
Mid-trial, John's attorney said that they were concerned that John was not competent to continue standing trial. They said that he had been hearing statements that were not made. According to his attorney, he also today has been displaying inappropriate laughter, which is a symptom that we have come to recognize sometimes when he does appear to be losing touch. John insisted that he was fine and that he was following the trial and not hallucinating. The trial was briefly halted while John was evaluated, and he was found to be competent. Dr. Michael Maher was called to testify in regards to John's mental health. He said that he believed that John met the criteria for insanity. According to Dr. Michael Maher, John remembered dropping Phoebe off the bridge and feeling that somehow this would have made her safe. Dr. Peter Burstyn also testified that he had gone over the PCLR, which is a psychopathy checklist, to determine John's mental state. He said that John fit the majority of the criteria and was experiencing various mental stages when he killed Phoebe. He said, "It would be easy to say that all of these psychotic symptoms were present, and therefore, Mr. John Chuck, because of these symptoms were present, he had to be legally insane." The prosecutors then called their own rebuttal witnesses, Dr. Emily Lazarou. Dr. Lazarou found John to not be mentally ill, but said he had personality disorders. She said that John was malingering psychotic symptoms or exaggerating an illness that he did not have. She even ruled him out as having bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. She also claimed that his so-called delusions were out of character for a psychotic patient. Following all of the testimony, it was time for closing arguments. During the prosecution's closing arguments, they once again reiterated their belief that John knew exactly what he was doing and knew that it was wrong when he threw Phoebe off the bridge. He said that the murder was premeditated and said that the fact that John fled from the scene was evidence that he knew what he was doing was wrong.
A lot of people might say, how could you ever do that in front of a police officer? But when you are that angry, when you are in that much of a rage, he didn't care. He didn't care if it was a cop or not a cop. He was going to do what he was going to do. He was going to do the one act that could hurt as many people in his life as possible. The people who had rejected him, the mother of Phoebe and his own mother, in one act. It was not a psychotic act because the supposed delusion wasn't followed. It was anger, unbridled anger. It was rage that drove him to do it on the top of that bridge. And if he's not insane, if he's not insane, they have not proven it to you, then we go back to, did he commit the murder? And the answer is yes.
Defense Manuel rebutted this and said that John was insane at that moment and didn't know what he was doing. She stated, "We know he had an overwhelming sense of fear. He felt that somebody was after him and Phoebe." The prosecution had the last word, with prosecutor Doug Ellis stating, "It wasn't insanity. It was all the issues in his life building up. Lack of money, lack of friends and family support, lack of shelter." In Florida, there is no option of giving a verdict finding somebody guilty but mentally ill. The jury either had to find John guilty of first-degree murder or not guilty by reason of insanity. If he were found not guilty, then John would be sent to a mental health treatment center, sent to an outpatient treatment program, or even let go. The jury deliberated for just 6.5 hours before returning with a verdict.
The matter of State of Florida versus John Chuck, case number 15-00226 CF, murder in the first degree. We, the jury, find as follows as the defendant in this case. Defendant is guilty of murder in the first degree as charged. So say we all sign the foreperson of the jury.
They unanimously found John Chuck guilty of first degree murder. The first degree murder conviction automatically came with a life sentence. John's defense team requested that the sentencing be postponed, but Judge Chris Hellinger refused and sentenced John to life in prison. Young Phoebe has not been forgotten. Each year on the anniversary of her death, her family, friends, and even strangers commemorate her short life by throwing flowers into Tampa Bay.
When you look at a little girl and she's dancing and you see her smile and you see her little ringlets of hair and she was so young and you just, how in the world? Nobody can do that.
I just couldn't believe that a father could do something like that. I mean, he just took his daughter and he threw her away. How do you do that?
Okay, and I think about that when we drop the flowers in. I think here's a little girl not being forgotten. I don't think there's anybody with a heart that wasn't impacted. I don't think there's anybody who ever cared about a child in their life that wouldn't have greatly cared about something like that happening.
We're going to make sure that she's remembered in the community and everybody else's hearts. That's the way I look at it. And that's why I did it. I still can't believe it years later. It just bothers me so much. It makes me sick to my stomach.
I like it when they float that way towards that part of the bridge. So for you, Phoebe.
In Phoebe Johnchuk's short 5 years of life, she was moved from pillar to post and had to watch violent altercations between her parents. By just 5 years old, she already had a long history with Child Protective Services and had teetered on the brink of disaster for the majority of those years. Despite drug use, domestic violence, instability, and neglect, the system put in place to protect children failed tremendously. All through her tumultuous life, Phoebe clung to her father. She clung on to him up until the very last moment when he carried her over the handrail and threw her 62 feet into the dark water. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said thank you at the start to my new Patreon supporter, but I'd also like to say another massive thank you. I'm going to be recording a new episode of Morbidology Plus, which will be up on Patreon on Himalaya Plus shortly. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews up on Apple or wherever else you're listening are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I would be eternally grateful. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, followed me on social media, sent me a message on social media. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Prash's Murder Map. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hey everyone, this is Prash, host of Prash's Murder Map. Pack your passport and jump on a plane, because I'd like to take you on a journey to investigate some of the most heinous, macabre, and enigmatic murders across the globe and throughout history. We'll look at forensics, psychology, and more as we dissect solved and unsolved cases like Australia's Frankston Killer and a murderous family on the American frontier. If you'd like to give my podcast a try, you can find me on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Hope to see you soon.